welcome to the September edition of the Astropod. I'm Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Anna Quiter.
Well, welcome back, listeners. We've had a short summer break, but the world of astronomy has been going on as ever. What's been happening, Anna?
Well, so, Quincy, there was the Perseid meteor shower. Did you get a chance to see it?
Well, I was actually up in Scotland whilst it was going on, and I had a little brass telescope with me, but all I could see was the ships in the harbour, far too cloudy up in the north.
Oh, surprisingly, it was actually pretty clear here in Cambridge, so I got to see it with a group of students I had out here at the IOA.
See any fantastically bright meteorites?
Actually, yeah, there were a few very bright ones. You know, so all the students were wishing on their shooting stars and things, but yeah, the meteor shower was actually not nearly as bright as Jupiter was.
Really? What's Jupiter been up to?
Jupiter actually had a really awesome alignment of its moons. Four of its moons were lined up on one side, so we got the historical telescopes out here and had a look at the moon alignment. It was pretty awesome.
Are those the Galilean moons?
Yep, those are the Galilean moons that he was able to see with his small telescope.
Fantastic. Now, I hear there's some kind of big black spot on a planet as well.
Yeah, so it turns out back in July, an amateur astronomer in Australia noticed that there was a large new black blotch on Jupiter.
Any ideas where this big black blotch comes from? Or is it just sort of, you know, getting a few spots as it goes through puberty?
Well, actually, Quincy, it turns out that a comet actually just hit Jupiter. And it left a big black spot that's about 5,000 miles long. Now, interestingly, 15 years ago, another comet struck Jupiter. But the one 15 years ago we were actually looking for. So we watched it break up in Jupiter's atmosphere and see lots of large chunks pummel the surface of Jupiter.
Yeah, I think I remember that, Anna, because astronomers had a pretty good idea that this was going to impact on the planet. But did we realize anything was going to hit Jupiter this time around, or was it a complete freak of nature?
No, it was a complete surprise, and it was even more interesting that an amateur astronomer found it, so the professionals weren't even looking for anything.
Wow, exciting times. And I think it just goes to prove that if you are an amateur astronomer, you know, there are still things out there that you can help discover and really help science.
That's true, and it shows the value of small telescopes.
Certainly does. Well, speaking of, well, not amateur astronomy, but high-level astronomy, NASA have just finished testing their Ares 1 rocket. Now, this is the thing which is going to take the new Orion space capsule into space, which is due to replace the space shuttle.
Oh, so what is the Orion space capsule?
Well, it's basically their next-generation sort of, you know, space transport vehicle to do everything from sending sort of men up into space to men to the moon. But the interesting thing is the space shuttle is actually going to be retired next year, Anna. And this new, well, the Orion capsule isn't supposed to come until about, 2015, if it's on time. So there's a good sort of five-year gap where NASA's actually going to have to rely on perhaps European or Russian vehicles to get their men into space.
That'll lead for some interesting discussions in the space shuttle, I'm sure.
Certainly will, Anna. We're all looking forward to it. So what have we got onto this month's show?
Well, so this month we're going to have What's Up in the Sky at Night. We're going to have a news section with Laura. We're going to have the history feature and the highlight of the interview.
That's right, and this month, Anna, I'm talking with Jay Farihi about a really interesting topic, I think, which is debris disks around white dwarfs, and white dwarfs are obviously the remnant of, stars like our sun. So it's really interesting to find debris disks around these objects.
Very interesting. Look forward to it.
Well, let's get on with it now, Anna. Let's go to the news with Laura.
Hello, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Least dense exoplanet yet is orbiting the wrong way. Planet hunters from the UK have discovered the most bloated exoplanet yet. WASP 17 is extra large, with a radius twice that of Jupiter, but is only 40% of Jupiter's mass, so it's only 6% as dense, which gives it the same density as expanded polystyrene. Even more extraordinary, it's going the wrong way around its home star, in the opposite direction to the star's direction of rotation, making it the first exoplanet known to have a retrograde orbit. The planet must have flipped direction in its orbit after a near miss with another huge planet, which swung it around like a slingshot. This indicates a violent history for this system, involving planet-planet or planet-star scattering and collisions. WASP-17's bloated radius could be due to tidal heating, as it's very close to the star, completing an orbit in less than 4 days. Due to its low mass and huge radius, WASP-17 has a very low surface gravity, so its atmosphere is the thickest of any known planet, making it a good target for transmission spectroscopy. Transmission spectroscopy is when astronomers look through the atmosphere of a planet to find out what substances are present and could give us clues to WASP-17's composition. Amino acid found in Stardust comet sample. NASA scientists studying the comet samples returned by the Stardust spacecraft have discovered glycine, a fundamental building block of life. Stardust captured the samples from Comet Vilt 2 in 2004 and returned them to Earth in 2006. Glycine is an amino acid, one of the building blocks of proteins, and this is the first time an amino acid has been found in a comet. As Stardust passed through the dense gas and dust surrounding the icy nucleus of Vilt 2, special collection grids filled with aerogel, a novel sponge-like material that's more than 99% empty space, gently captured samples of the comet's gas and dust. However, since glycine is used by terrestrial life, at first the team was unable to rule out contamination from sources on Earth. The new research analysed the isotopes in the foil in Stardust collectors to rule out that possibility. Isotopes are versions of an element with different masses due to different numbers of neutrons. For example, the most common carbon atom, carbon-12, has 6 protons and 6 neutrons in its nucleus. However, carbon-13 has an extra neutron. A glycine molecule of extraterrestrial origin will tend to have more of the heavier carbon-13 atoms in it than glycine that's from Earth, which is exactly what the team found, confirming that the glycine probably didn't originate on Earth. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Thanks very much, Laura. So this month, in light of the interview, which is on white dwarf stars, we're going to be talking in the history section about the human side of the historical development of white dwarf theory. In 1935, astronomers were interested in the theory behind how stars evolve. It was already accepted that average stars spend most of their lives fusing lighter elements into heavier elements within their cores. The energy released by this process is what supports the star from collapsing in on itself under the action of gravity. It was also known that what was left after a star was no longer able to support itself was a small, dense object that was not very bright. The theory to explain these stellar remnants, called white dwarfs, was a real problem for astronomers as well as the broader physics community. Enter a young researcher at the University of Cambridge named Subramanian Chandrasekhar, nicknamed Chandra. By 1935, at the age of 24, he'd been working for several years on the theory of what happens to an average-sized star when it reaches the end of its life and becomes a white dwarf. Chandra worked out that the limit to how massive a white dwarf can be is about 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. This is called the Chandrasekhar limit. But Chandra didn't stop there. He also proposed that if a stellar remnant was larger than 1.4 solar masses, it would be unable to halt the gravitational collapse of its core, and an even smaller, denser object would result, a black hole. This idea that stars of different masses evolve differently was a breakthrough in astronomy. On January 11, 1935, Chandra presented his findings in a talk at a meeting of the Royal Astronomical Society in London, which was a leading forum for discussion of astrophysics. Sir Arthur Eddington, an eminent figure in early 20th century astrophysics, with positions such as the Plumian Professor of Astronomy and Experimental Philosophy at Cambridge, as well as director of the Cambridge Observatory here on the grounds of the Institute of Astronomy, was in attendance at Chandra's talk. After the talk, Eddington rose and spoke out strongly against Chandra's work. Eddington primarily argued his belief that stars should not be able to collapse down into black holes, saying, "I think there should be a law of nature to prevent a star from behaving in this absurd way." Sadly, many European scientists were not willing to stand in defense of Chandra's work because of Eddington's stature, even though numerous of them believed it. This led Chandra to leave for the United States and to switch research topics, derailing this line of research for years. Chandra's work began to receive validation during World War II when it was found to be instrumental to the atomic bomb. Chandra finally received the recognition he deserved when he was awarded the 1983 Nobel Prize in Physics. NASA has also named the Chandra X-ray Observatory, one of its great space telescopes, after him. To learn more about modern research into white dwarfs, here we have Quincy speaking with Jay Farihi in this month's interview.
Hello and welcome to the interview section of this month's AstroPod. This month I'm very pleased to introduce Jay Farihi from the University of Leicester. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Jay, this month we're going to be exploring white dwarfs and the possible fate of our own solar system. But at first, a brief introduction about yourself. I mean, you started off your PhD at UCLA in America before going to the Gemini Observatories. And then you came to the University of Leicester here in Britain. So it's really great to have you on the show, and let's start off by talking about white dwarfs. For those of us out there who don't know what a white dwarf is, what is a white dwarf?
Well, white dwarfs are essentially Earth-sized stellar embers. They don't produce energy. They just slowly cool off for all eternity, essentially. What's interesting about them is that they represent the fate of the majority of all stars in the Milky Way, including our sun. So when our sun is finished producing energy, it will shed its outer layers and reduce itself in size to an Earth-sized hot stellar corpse, as we call it. And then it will slowly cool for billions of years. That's essentially what a white dwarf is. It's the fate that awaits our sun and most suns in the galaxy.
So we don't expect planets to survive around white dwarfs themselves, do we?
Well, one of the misconceptions, I think, that even those people who did their kind of astronomy for poets class somewhere along the way is that stars as a whole explode and finish their lives that way. But that's not true. The way white dwarfs, or the stars that become white dwarfs, shed their outer layers is very, very much nonviolent. And so the one thing that would prevent planetary systems from persisting is the size of the star that precedes the white dwarf, the giant. And that giant can extend out to about one Earth-Sun distance or a few Earth-Sun distances. However, Jupiter, Saturn, and the other gas giants are further out than that, and so it's thought almost certainly those planets will survive in our solar system, as will probably Mars and the asteroid belt. Maybe not the Earth, unfortunately, but that remains to be seen. I like to tell people I'm working on it.
Just trying to save the Earth there. So you're looking at white dwarfs. How are you actually able to detect sort of the remains of planets or actual planets around these stars?
The first clue we have that there might be planetary systems remaining at white dwarfs is the fact that their atmospheres should be pure hydrogen or helium, because their intense gravitational fields would pull down elements heavier than these, such as calcium, magnesium, and iron. And yet when we look at many white dwarfs, we see these elements such as calcium in their upper atmospheres. And so we know that this has to be an external pollutant, because even if some calcium falls onto the surface of a white dwarf, it then would sink away rapidly in the high gravity. So in these systems where we see calcium polluting a white dwarf, we know that that's coming from its near environment. And calcium is a major element in rocks in our own solar system, in asteroids, comets, Earth, Mars, etc. So that was our first clue that they might be polluted with terrestrial-like material. We then went after them with the Spitzer Space Telescope, which has sensitive infrared instruments, which detected small particles of dust in close orbit, basically shredded rocks.
So looking at the metals you find in white dwarfs, it's really just an indicator to tell you that something is bombarding these white dwarfs.
That's exactly right.
So when you find, when you follow up the observations and you do find, sort of debris disks around white dwarfs, what are you actually being able to tell about these debris disks?
Well, one of the things that it tells us is we get a little bit of the composition from this, from the infrared telescope, when we take a spectrum, when we break up the light into its constituent elements. One of the things we learn is that it's rich in silicate, and silicates are essentially sand. You can think of it as sand. A large component of rocks on the Earth are rich in silicates. Silicates are composed of other elements, silicon, magnesium, calcium, oxygen. It's very similar to material we find on the Earth. And so this is another clue that these are rocky things which have been broken down into little bits about the white dwarf.
So is this dust that's falling onto the white dwarf, or is it larger particles?
We think it's dust, but we can't really be sure. There's only so much sensitivity, even with the best space observatories. It's more likely to be dust, small particles, like only you know, much less than a few centimeters in size. And the reason for this is in order to form the disk, the dust disk that we see, we expect that a large body has been broken up by the tidal gravity of the white dwarf, which is the same, very same process that produces Saturn's rings. And so when that happens, the rock breaks up and then self-collides, and just this collision just cascades until everything's broken down into very small bits.
So are we seeing the remains of a once planet, or is it just sort of, you know, an asteroid belt which is being crushed down into dust or something similar?
We think in one case we have good evidence that it was probably a planet, but we can't say for sure. We like asteroids because in our own solar system they're relatively nearby, and so that they could come in and form a disk rather quickly, as opposed to comets, which are on very long eccentric orbits, and that would take many thousands of years to form a disk. We also like asteroids because that allows this phenomenon of a polluted white dwarf, also surrounded by dust, to occur over a certain percentage of the white dwarf lifetime. It wouldn't just happen once. You could send in an asteroid, you know, once every 100,000 years or once every 10,000 years. But to answer your question truthfully, minor planets or asteroids or major planets are both possibilities of these stars.
So just how often do you find evidence of these disks?
If you take the polluted stars, which are the ones that we surveyed with the Spitzer Infrared Telescope, and you place them into larger samples of white dwarfs that are not polluted, in other words, representing all white dwarfs, and ask what percentage of those have debris disks that we see with Spitzer, the answer is at least 1-3% of all white dwarfs have both polluted atmospheres and rocky debris in orbit about them. And that tells us their main sequence, their energy-producing suns that preceded them as white dwarfs, those stars, at least 1-3% of them, had rocky planets. This is because asteroids are the building blocks of terrestrial planets in our own solar system. So whether we're seeing the remnants of a planet or an asteroid, in either case, these white dwarfs represent regular energy-producing stars that had terrestrial planetary systems.
I guess what's really exciting about this is, up to now, most of our sort of planet-finding techniques have found big gaseous giants very close to stars. And what you're actually telling us is that you've got evidence of terrestrial planets, planets like our Earth, near stars like our sun.
That's true. The radio velocity technique, although they say very often that they've found another super Earth, they're finding at the smallest Neptune mass planets, essentially. And they like to call some of these Neptune mass planets, or slightly less massive than Neptune guys, they like to call them super Earths, and they like to claim that they're rocky, but there is no evidence of that. And here with the white dwarfs, we can say with some confidence that the material is rocky because it is very rich in hardy elements like iron and magnesium, which are hard to destroy, and very poor in volatile elements such as sodium and hydrogen and carbon, which are kind of easily burned into gaseous form. And that is an indicator, that's basically saying that the stuff is rocky or rock-like.
Now, we know that sort of white dwarfs have been found in sort of binary star systems. Is there any evidence for these kind of, you know, disks around white dwarfs in binary systems, or do they just not exist?
No, to the best of our knowledge, the indications are that these are not binary systems. Although with only a little bit of the picture in hand, you might suspect that, because interacting binaries can produce some related phenomena. In these cases, the white dwarf is shining so feebly that if you look in the infrared, you would unmistakably see the companion star. Because regular stars like our sun are at their smallest Jupiter-sized, but white dwarfs are Earth-sized. And so, as I told somebody one time, you can't hide an elephant behind a golf ball. So there's no way to hide a companion star there, really.
So we're almost running out of time now, Jay. So just last question. Now, we're always very excited when we can directly image, you know, planets or, you know, evidence of planets or disks of planets. Do you think there's any likelihood in the future that we'll be able to directly image disks around white dwarfs?
The disks that we have found so far are really right on top of the white dwarf. Of all the instruments I know of, there is an instrument called ALMA, which is essentially a radio telescope array being built in the desert of Chile that may be able to get some images of these. It's tough. They're really small. In fact, the size of the dust disk is smaller than the size of our sun. So we generally can't see the disks of other stars. We can't resolve them into a disk like our sun. But there is hope. We're young. There's plenty of time and lots of smart people out there. So I think eventually, yes.
Fantastic. Well, Jay, we wish you the best of luck. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Quincy and Jay. Now here we have Alex doing the sky at night.
Up in the skies this month, with a new moon occurring on the 18th of September, the skies will be dark enough to see some of the faintest planets in the solar system. Looking to the south below Pisces, which is below Pegasus, you can find Uranus with a pair of binoculars as it moves down towards Aquarius. On around the 17th of September, the asteroid Juno will be about 4 degrees to the left of Uranus, and so with binoculars or a small telescope, you should be able to see both, although you may need to take a photo of the region over a few nights and see if they move in order to be sure that you did actually see them. In these dark skies, it will also be possible to see Neptune with good binoculars, as it lies towards the south near the constellation Capricornus. First, find Jupiter shining brightly in the south and move about 4 to 6 degrees to the left to the star Delta Capricorni, and then go up about a degree to find Neptune's faint bluish disk. Late in the evening of the 12th of September, the moon will appear to clip the edge of the open cluster M35 in Gemini, making an interesting sight. Due to the glare of the moon, binoculars or a small telescope are recommended in order to be able to make out some of the hundreds of stars in the cluster. And finally, a mention must go to the Perseid meteor shower last month, which peaked on August 12th, and at its height produced an observed rate of a meteor a minute. I hope some of our listeners managed to see this display, with the meteors appearing to radiate from the constellation Perseus in the northeast. This meteor shower is due to the Earth passing through the debris trail of the comet 109P Swift-Tuttle. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Quentin and Anna.
Well, listeners, just in case you are worried because Anna didn't mention it earlier in the show, it is time for our astronomy joke of the month.
Hey, Jane.
Hi, Michelle.
So, did you hear this month about the Ministry of Defence releasing all their files about UFO sightings in Britain?
Oh, I heard something.
Yeah, quite interesting. I once saw a flying saucer.
Really?
Yep, it was shortly followed by a flying teacup.
Ooh, thanks for that, Jane and Michelle. I'm sure we'll have some more lead-based banter from you next month.
I don't think it's that toxic.
I think it is, Anna. I think it is. Well, we'll see you all next month.
Thanks for listening.